Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss the happenings of the week in New Zealand and abroad. And we're now into the second half of the year, and we will begin once again with international issues. I think that worked quite well when we did it last time. So welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dewa. Thanks for having me on again.
And we're going to start with the Joe Biden and Donald Trump debate that captured the international news over the past week. And I think the implications of that are, well, potentially going to be far, far-reaching, because there's a big discussion now about what's going to happen to Joe Biden and whether the election is going to go ahead as planned. What are your initial impressions, or they're not initial impressions, but after a week of thinking about it, what are your impressions of the debate?
Well, poking fun at Joe Biden's mental state has been an online sport for quite a while now, I think the entirety of his presidency. And so it shouldn't really have come as much of a surprise that he was a little bit forgetful, that he is not quite as sharp as what he used to be, that sometimes he trails off, that sometimes he fails to make it to the end of his sentences. Yet nevertheless, the reaction to the debate has been one of incredible surprise and shock and horror from the Democratic Party, from the mainstream media, and from most of the people you would expect who would be supporting Biden. And I just find it remarkable that they were surprised that this is what happened, when we've been talking about it, pointing it out, and making fun of it online for how many years is it now? 3 years, 4 years, even longer. So, I mean, the big question now is whether they'll be able to oust him. And there's a lot of talk about whether they're going to oust him at the Democratic convention coming up, which will be quite spectacular if that's what happens. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see. That, I mean, you would have to think, what's really worrying about this is that the President of the United States is probably the most powerful position in the world, at least on paper. And you really want someone who is at the top of their game in that role. If you're not at your top of your game in that role, you really don't have to be on top of your game in any role, anywhere, do you?
Well, I think Joe Biden is there on purpose. Like the deep state, as it's called, they like having Joe Biden there because he's less of a nuisance than any other president might be. And I think for many, many years, basically since FDR in the United States, the original New Deal that they're naming the current Green New Deal after, that was basically a massive bureaucratic state was set up, and the bureaucratic state runs itself. And every now and then, it tries to pass off the difficult decisions. If it sort of gets stuck, it passes those off to the president, so that the president can be blamed if something goes wrong, but nobody in terms of, you know, who's actually running the bureaucracy behind the scenes is ever responsible for anything that happens, and they make most of the decisions. And I guess if you have a headstrong president, if you've got someone with all their faculties in charge, they might just be more annoying, if anything, to the actual people who are running the country.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's a bureaucratic rule by experts, technocratic rule by experts. And the president's really just the figurehead who's there to take the blame when the experts get it wrong. That's not real democracy, though, is it? That's not what it's supposed to be. And that's not what most people, up until perhaps very recently, thought that that's what it was or what it ought to be.
Yeah, they've let the mask slip off completely, basically. They've given up any pretense that they need a competent man running things, because they thought, well, you know what, at this stage, who cares? And they're going to keep on going, because Joe Biden wants to keep on going. And I don't blame him either. When you're that age, when things are getting, you know, not going off, I guess, south in terms of your health, and you're not getting any younger for sure, you're happy to be the president, right? Otherwise, they're going to shuffle you off into the retirement home. No one's ever going to visit you again. So Joe Biden himself, as far as he's still there, when he's there, then, you know, he's happy to stay put. His wife's happy for him to stay put. His son, apparently, one of his closest advisors is his son, who's, well, a criminal, people who are listening to RCR will be aware of Hunter Biden's escapades and his involvement with the Ukrainian oil companies and laundering millions of dollars and everything from drugs to all kinds of other degenerate behavior. And basically, you've got the mainstream media now openly saying, oh, yes, Hunter Biden is one of Joe Biden's closest advisors and wants him to continue. Well, of course he does.
Yeah, well, apparently Hunter Biden is now in the White House. He's in there because he says he doesn't trust the advice that his father's been getting. So he's in there advising him in person. So isn't that wonderful? Hunter Biden helping his old man out in his time of need. But the debate, if nothing else, I mean, even if the presidency is a joke, as we're sort of discussing here, the debate performance has still done real damage to Biden in the polls. The polls are turning. Trump was already probably ahead in most of the polls prior to the debate, and now he's looks like he's getting much further ahead. So if there was ever a time to replace a president, it would be now. So you'd have to think a lot of people within the Democratic Party are thinking that.
Well, they've got about 3 months until the election and everything is over for them. Very hard to predict, very uncertain times. And it's one of these times where everything happens all at once, which is great. It's wonderful to be covering the news when everything goes wrong at once. Obviously, the people who are having things go wrong for them are not having fun, but certainly the commentator class that we're part of is having fun. And the debate, I think I agree with you, Donald Trump did well enough to get to keep the momentum going that he had, right? When they convicted him on bogus charges, that was helpful to him. Having Joe Biden freeze up in the debates, that was very helpful to him. He's not doing anything spectacular. He's just doing his normal thing, being who he is. And that's really good enough in his situation.
Yeah. I mean, the story after the debate wasn't about anything that Trump did. It was about Biden and his cognitive decline. Trump was Trump, you know. He gave long, he gave rambling answers. Now, he probably said less outrageous things than he has in debates in the past, but that was fine because the story wasn't about Trump, it was about Biden.
Yeah, I noticed at least a few times when I was watching little snippets of it, because I was busy and didn't see the whole thing, but I tuned in for little bits and pieces, and he did seem to do an okay job of bringing things back to the border, to illegal immigration. He'd get a question about climate change, and he'd say, you know, he'd answer the question about climate change by saying, oh, there are millions of illegals pouring over the southern border. He'd just stick to his points and ignore the questions. And yeah, helpful. That's really what the election is going to be about for the people who actually care.
Yeah, and Biden was quite helpful in that respect too. He brought a couple of the questions back to immigration himself in his own absent-mindedness as well, which sort of reminded people of the important issue he's failing terribly on.
Now, another international issue, staying in the United States, two key Supreme Court rulings in the last week as well. The first one is going to be a lesser known issue, but I think the implications of it are quite large. And this was the Supreme Court overturning the Chevron deference, as it is known. This is ruling has been in place for about 40 or 50 years. And basically, as I understand it, it means that the law or the interpretation of the law is deferred to the experts. So they had a case of, say, fishing regulations or environmental regulations. However, the experts, the bureaucrats interpreted these regulations, they would then be enforced on the people, you know, using this Chevron deference. And the Supreme Court has basically tossed this out, which opens, I guess, massive possibilities for a lot of bureaucratic nonsense to be overturned. So let me know if I understand that correctly and if I understand the implications and any other thoughts you might have.
That's basically right. So Chevron deference precedent set quite a high bar for overturning legislative interpretations of federal administrative agencies. So basically the federal agencies could interpret legislation however they liked as long as it wasn't quote-unquote unreasonable. That ruling, that precedent has now been thrown out, and the judiciary is now able to interpret legislation according to its own best judgment, rather than deferring and only overruling when the administrative agency's understanding is unreasonable. So the big picture here is that this is an attack on the idea of technocratic governance by experts. So ever since probably the New Deal, FDR's administration, the the shape of government in the United States, and then following that are most modern democratic governments, the governments in most modern democratic countries, were fundamentally shifted towards a larger government full of so-called experts who, you know, sort of, you know, micromanaged various parts of the economy, various parts of society, using information, you know, and analysis from academia, and you know, so it was a whole big program that supported sort of big government and rule by experts, and that replaced in America the previous governing setup that was really more of a limited government setup that was ruled by a sort of constitutional framework of limited and enumerated powers. And while the US still has a constitution and still on paper is a government of limited and enumerated powers, in reality, that's not really what's happening. It's got a sprawling administrative state. So this ruling really sets the stage for what the Trump campaign and a potential Trump administration has said it will do, which is to really go after, attack, and cut down the power and the size and the scope of the administrative state. And this ruling really enables that now. It enables legal challenges to many of the interpretations of federal laws that administrative agencies are undertaking.
And I think the important part for even New Zealand in this particular ruling is, as you've mentioned, the influence on the entire world through, you know, the globalizing influence of America and its legal system and so on has been massive. And so it potential, you know, the potential here, not just for America, but for the world, it remains to be seen, but it could be a massive change, especially when it comes to crippling climate regulations that are, you know, being placed on people in the United States, and that flow-on effect that it has all the way out to New Zealand and the furthest little outposts of the American Empire, as it might be called. The other big ruling, and this is the one that got all the news, but probably has fewer implications, at least in my opinion, is that the Supreme Court also ruled that the president has immunity when he is using his official powers. This basically prevents any prosecution of actions that Donald Trump took when he was president. Your thoughts on this before I read out, well, the dissent that the liberal justices gave to this was very funny, in my opinion. We'll talk about that. But I think the ruling itself, what do you think about the implications of it?
Well, I mean, I think one of the negative trends in America over recent years and sort of culminating in the last Trump administration and the current troubles that Trump is facing is the use of what's called lawfare to undermine the power, the authority of the president, and to undermine Trump's presidential campaign as well by tying him up in lawsuits so he can never get anything done, sabotaging his campaign, even the threat of legal action. The president is really there to make as a final decision maker, at least on paper. We've discussed how it's not always like that in reality. But according to the constitutional setup, the president is there as a final decision maker to make the really tough decisions. And for that office to function effectively, he really ought to be thinking about what's best for the country and what needs to be done, not what am I going to be personally legally liable for. Having said that, there may be some issues here. I mean, there's a legitimate argument about what the scope of the president's power ought to be and how he is constrained and ought to be constrained legally. So I'm a little bit open-minded here, but I think probably on balance, this is a good thing. Presidents shouldn't have the threat of lawfare, you know, hanging over them and influencing their decision-making on these really important issues.
Yeah, to sort of bring this across to New Zealand, it's kind of like the things that we've seen, not quite lawfare, but basically, say, for instance, the use of the Waitangi Tribunal to try and put a spanner in the works of the government's agenda and so on. It's fallen flat in New Zealand, but you can see that very American attitude filtering its way here, where it's like trying to use lawfare to cripple the government's agenda. Like, this is a democratically elected government that's implementing the will of the people, and then it's being attacked by its enemies through the legal system. And that's what's been happening in America for years and years. And it's great, hopefully great to see a stop put to that. I'm going to read out a section here from Sotomayor's dissent to this. She says, I quote, "The president of the United States is the most powerful person in the country and possibly the world. When he uses his official powers in any way under the majority's reasoning, he will now be insulated from criminal prosecution. Orders the Navy's SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon? Immune. 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 Let the president violate the law. Let him exploit the trappings of his office for personal gain. Let him use his official powers for evil ends." And so on. In every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. End quote. What do you think of that dramatic dissent from the progressive judges?
Well, I mean, she sounds like she needs to have a cold shower, really. I think she's getting a wee bit too excited there. I mean, I think, to be fair, I think there are some legitimate issues. I mean, we talk a lot about liberal democracy and that most Western countries are a liberal democracy. And what a liberal democracy entails is really a balance of power between the rule of law and legal protections for the rights of individuals and sometimes groups, and the will of the people as represented by through the majority vote mechanism. And sometimes those things are in tension, and we talk about the tyranny of the majority and, you know, enshrining human rights as being something to prevent the tyranny of the majority. But I think on balance, my analysis of what's been going on in the Western world for a while now is that the balance of power between the will of the majority and the legal protections for minorities has moved too far in favor of the legal protections for minorities. We're almost, it's almost as if the minorities are bossing the majority around now in Western democracies. And I think that that's gone a little bit too far. So I think the balance does need to go back the other way, but you do always need to be careful because the tyranny of the majority is a real thing, and vulnerable minorities, I think, really do need to be protected, and there ought to be protections in law for that.
This is a good opportunity to go into the free speech update, and we haven't had one in a few weeks, but there are three little subjects to cover here in our free speech update. The first is Julian Assange's release. The second is going to be Chloe Schwalbrick's repeating her "from the river to the sea" comments. And the third, speaking of minority protections, the Law Commission issuing a paper on human rights protections for trans people and basically arguing that there might, you know, should maybe be penalties for people dead naming or misgendering. So I'm going to let you tackle those in whichever order you like in some rapid fire form. Take it away.
Well, let's start with the Law Commission one first, because this is something I really just want to alert people to. So the Law Commission is doing a piece of work on whether the current human rights protections in the Human Rights Act are adequate for transgender people. So it's not just transgender people, non-binary people, and intersex people, I think, are the three categories. And the problem we've had in our political debates around this issue for quite a while now is that many of the demands of the transgender community are at odds with women's rights in many ways. So transgender people want to be able to, you know, trans women want to be able to use the women's toilet, but, you know, women want to protect that space for biological women. Transgender people want to be able to participate in the women's sports divisions, but biological women want to keep that division for them, so they don't have to compete with people who have been exposed to testosterone and perhaps have an unfair athletic advantage, and also to keep themselves safe from people who are much bigger and stronger competing against them. So that's the issue there. Something to think about here is the Australian Human Rights Commission actually ran a consultation on exactly this issue, and they ran it in a very unfair and biased way. They basically tilted the playing field in favour of the trans people and against women. And they went so far as to not even accept submissions from women's groups and to sort of conflate women's groups and other people who were sort of gender critical or hold to the what we now have to call the traditional definition of a woman.
With
terrorism, with, you know, people who are on the pipeline to radical far-right extremism. So I think the rhetoric on this stuff has gotten well out of hand. And people who think a woman is a biological category are not radical extremists. And I just want to alert people to the fact that this is going on and make sure that we don't have something, we don't have these protections for radical gender ideology snuck into our human rights laws, and then that results in taking away protections for women. So that's that issue.
I'll just put a quick plug in here for an article I wrote this week on rightminds.nz called the Funeral Pyre of Progress. If you go to rightminds.nz, it should be at the top or near the top. And I discussed this issue of everyone being radical far-right extremists and its eventual consequences. But yeah, that's basically right. You're going to get into a situation where the Law Commission is going to say anyone who's normal is a radical far-right extremist, whatever those implications might be. And with that, we'll carry straight on to Chloe Schwalbrook's comments then. From the river to the sea, she repeated it again at a rally recently and has sort of kickstarted the free speech, hate speech debate on that again. You know, are her words violence? Is she promoting violence and so on?
No, she's not promoting violence necessarily. I mean, you can see why members of the Jewish community, Zionists, don't like what she's arguing for. Personally, I don't support what she's saying either, but it's a free society in New Zealand. We ought to be able to, and I think our government has held to a very neutral stance between, you know, the Israelis and the Palestinians. And it's totally appropriate that anyone should be able to take sides in that debate or remain neutral if they want to. Chloe had to go to arbitration, or that's not the correct word, but mediation or something like that with the Human Rights Commission over using these comments in the past. And so she's being quite defiant and using them again here. But I mean, I think for what it's worth, I think good on her. She should be able to say it. You should be able to say things like that, even if people disagree with you, without having to, you know, get tied up with silly things that the Human Rights Commission wants to do.
And it sounds very similar to your own situation.
Yeah, I mean, they want to do the same thing to me as well. But so, yeah, so I have a wee bit of empathy for Chloe, not on the substance, but on the, you know, the procedural. Yeah,
exactly. Certainly. Although I doubt she's going to have any empathy for you. But anyway, that is unfortunately what it is. If you believe that people should be free to say things, they don't necessarily agree back, right?
Yeah, that's the one.
And finally, Julian Assange's release, sort of, I guess. I'll let you say whatever you like about that. It did happen just over a week ago, I think, but we didn't have a show last week, so it's great to quickly touch on that.
Well, I mean, this is about free speech as well, although it's quite controversial. I mean, governments have spies and they have classified information, and there is a need to keep operations secret if you're a government. However, what Julian Assange argued in court or outside the court at the hearing was that the First Amendment in the United States and the laws around secrecy, government secrecy and classified information, are in conflict. And he felt at the time that what he was doing was in line with the First Amendment, but he's been forced to plead guilty and accept that according to laws around, you know, government secrecy and classified information, he would be found guilty. So, I mean, this is another important issue of tension and free speech. When can people who are doing something that's, if it's not journalism, it's very similar to journalism. I think what he was doing was journalism, and he was punished for it. When do national security considerations override free speech considerations? And that's a very difficult debate and something that needs to be thought through very carefully.
Yes, it's interesting that it's come to basically the point where he's ended up in court in front of a judge, ended up making a plea deal, and then eventually being released. And this, I remember very early on, I was quite young at the time, so I won't put too much weight on my opinions when I was a teenager, but it was sort of like, well, you know, at some stage, if the government said that you've committed a crime and you're going to end up in front of a judge, so you may as well go for that instead of hiding in the embassy, which he did for such a long time. And it was, of course, a protest for him. But yeah, I do wonder in the end if he would have, in a sense, been freed sooner if he had sort of put himself through these legal processes, or if, you know, maybe the fact that he held out against them is what resulted in quite a, I guess, the sentence was basically
that because he'd already been locked up for such a long time, they would basically say, well, that can count as your punishment. You've already been locked up. So
yeah, the process was
time already served, they said, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, it was that, definitely that. So, yeah,
so they're not exactly letting him off scot-free. They
no. Well, he was punished.
And it does set a very dangerous precedent, and perhaps a suppressing sort of precedent in future for people who want to go public with national security information or information that compromises national security. So the government still got its way kind of in the end, didn't it? There's still a big disincentive there. Julian Assange was punished. He was locked up for a long time, even if the US government couldn't do it itself. And there is a precedent now to punish people who make public national security information.
Yes, the process was the punishment, indeed. Some good news, perhaps, now moving closer to home, the expanded COVID inquiry. I haven't asked you about that on the show before, even though it's a slightly older news at this stage. What do you think of the expanded terms and I guess the second phase of the COVID inquiry? Is this a big win for us, or is it a nothing burger at the end of the day?
Well, I mean, I think if the expanded review goes ahead and genuinely looks into the things that are in that terms of reference, it does count as a big win. It's something that wouldn't have happened were it not for all the activism and the protest and the activity that people concerned about COVID engaged in New Zealand at the time of COVID and then up to and around the election. So the terms of reference say they're going to look into things like vaccine safety and efficacy, which is a huge win, because if you remember back, no one wanted to touch that in terms of an expanded terms of reference a year or 2 years ago prior to the election. So the pressure that's been put on has made a difference there. They're also going to look into lockdowns, whether they were too long, whether they were too harsh. They're going to look into whether a lot of the other restrictions that were put in place were justified when you look at the socioeconomic consequences that followed from them. So these are all basically the right sorts of things. I'm sure you can find other things that you could put into those terms of reference, but I think the things that are in there now are the main things. Perhaps the glaring omission that a lot of people wanted to look into is the excess deaths. What's driving the excess deaths? Is it the vaccine? Is it other things? They're not going to look into that as far as I can see. So that may be one thing. But overall, I think this is a big one. The complaint that New Zealand First has and why they've activated the agree to disagree clause in the coalition agreement over this isn't around the second phase of the review we've been discussing. It's around that they're continuing with the current review that was already in place by Labor, and they're going to allow that current review to report back. And then they're going to activate the second phase of the review after that review reports back. The second phase with its expanded terms of reference after that. And Winston Peters and New Zealand First have complained about the first phase still going ahead because they say it's just a sort of political cover-up operation initiated by the Ardern government to try and report back and say that everything they did was wonderful, which, I mean, and he's probably right about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it will be great if that's what they do. And as predicted, then it proves that we were right all along. And as you said, in the past year, the changes have been massive. You think back to July of last year, this may have almost been unthinkable to get the kind of just even frank discussion about these things at the highest levels of government.
None of our politicians would meet with Parliament protesters. None of them would discuss a vaccine efficacy or anything at all. It was only because Winston Peters met with him and he was a point of difference. And there were the COVID protest people, the freedom protesters sort of got in behind him at election time and managed to get him across the line. And Winston, to his great credit, is showing loyalty to those people who supported him by getting this review over the line.
Now, a little bit of bad news then. The Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, an aptly named piece of legislation that probably is the complete opposite of what it says that it is, has been announced to be going ahead. And this is a Labour piece of legislation again. I see this as a betrayal by Luxon and Goldsmith. It's pretty clear to me that Melissa Lee, who was the broadcasting minister, didn't want to continue with this. She kind of handled all of it kind of badly. But in the end, it seems like they just used that as a convenient tool to shuffle her out of the way so that they could get someone who wanted to actually continue working on this bill. the ACT party has protested against it. David Seymour triggered the agree to disagree clause on this as well. Although it seems like if the National Party supports it, the Labour Party supports it, it will go ahead no matter who opposes it. But on the whole, what's your view of the of this fair digital news bargaining bill and the effects that it might have on funding the legacy media, the mainstream media, from basically trying to force social media giants to pay them money for news?
Well, I mean, similar laws were passed in Australia and Canada, and in both countries, Meta, which is the Facebook parent company, in response to those laws, just stopped putting Australian and Canadian news on their platform. And so something similar could happen in New Zealand. So rather than do a deal and pay money to New Zealand news producers, they just won't run the news on their sites. So it makes things worse, well, from the government's perspective, at least on every level. The media gets no money and we also get no news online.
Now, so in Australia, potentially then this could actually be a good thing. I'm calling saying it's betrayal by Luxon and Goldsmith, but maybe it's 4D chess by Luxon and Goldsmith to make sure that mainstream media is no longer broadcast on social media anymore. Or am I thinking of?
I don't think so, because I mean, it'll still be available. I mean, it's still available on other online platforms apart from Meta or Facebook.
So do we know then if it's had any effect in Australia and Canada in terms of?
Well, Australia, the Australian government negotiated with Meta after they initially banned the news. And I think they've come to an arrangement now where news is still on Meta in Australia, but it isn't in Canada. So Canada, you can't get Canadian news on Facebook in Canada.
That's hilarious.
But that's a minor issue. The major issue here is that the media is left wing and National is ostensibly right wing. So the media are their political foes. In fact, in some senses, the media are a bigger and more important foe than the Labour Party is for the National Party. When you think about who really wields power in society these days, you can make a good case that it's the media who's really the most powerful entity. They're the ones who control the information landscape. And, you know, knowledge is power, information is power. And the people who are providing that information to the general population or not providing the information, which is really more of the case, are the ones who are controlling what people think. And if you can control the information that people have, you control what people think, you can also control how they vote. And this has been what's happening. And one of the great, and it's why the media has become so unpopular and untrusted. But that's actually a good thing, because what's happened as a result of that is that trust in news has fallen. People have switched off the mainstream news and started getting their information from these other sources, which has beginning to cause significant changes in the views of the public. And this is what we saw in the recent European elections, where the so-called far-right parties, you know, the populist right-wing anti-immigration parties, are gaining traction. It's part of what propelled Trump in 2016, and it's likely to propel him again. It's happening in the UK. So the change in the information ecosystem is having huge effects on voting, and it's helping, in many cases, parties to the right. So why National would want to bail out the mainstream media at the expense of the online platforms that are helping parties to the right is mysterious and baffling to me. I cannot understand why they would do that. I think it's poor political strategy. Doesn't make sense.
And it has the potential of sort of being seen as a public interest journalism fund 2.0. Is basically, hey, the National Party is bribing the media.
Willie Jackson explicitly, when he drafted the bill, he explicitly sold it as that, as a replacement for the public interest journalism funding when that fund ran out, except instead of the government providing the money directly, the bargaining scheme that's set up would require the large offshore platforms like Google, Facebook and others to do a deal with New Zealand news providers and then pay them for their content. So they get a revenue stream from the large social media companies. So that's how it works.
Well, in a bit of good news today, News Hub is officially dead. I don't know if the website becomes unavailable or whatever. You'd have to go and check that out after the show today or tomorrow. I'm not sure what time it dies as well. I haven't had a look. What's your view on this and tying this, I guess, back into the trouble that the media has been having in this bargaining bill as well for social media? The end of News Hub, your comments kind of obituary, as it may be, in just a very, very short space of time, seeing we only have about 5 minutes or so left.
Well, they lied to the New Zealand people. They consistently demonized them. They demonize people, the conservative half of the population, as racist, sexist, deplorables, you know, homophobes, bigots. They railed against their worldview constantly, rather than seeking understanding and to cater to that half of the population. And it's no wonder that people hate them, and it's no wonder that people stopped watching them. So I think it's just desserts. That's how things should happen in a free country, in a free market economy. When you provide a product that no one wants to watch, people stop watching it and you go out of business. That's how it should be.
And one of the, I don't know if I, journalists, I guess, one of the entertainers who worked for News Hub, Patrick Gower, has been writing for the New Zealand Herald already. Perhaps it's a new job for him. But the article that he wrote this week was basically saying that, well, old white men are scared of what's coming and that race relations in New Zealand are great if it weren't just for these old white men who are scared about, you know, what he wants done to them.
It's what they always do. They accuse you of the thing that they themselves are doing. So in that article, Patrick Gower said, oh, no, well, we, you know, people are stirring up division. They're stirring up hatred. And the problem is it's these old white men. They're really the problem. They're the ones who are doing it. So he's calling out people for stirring up division. He's telling people not to stir up division while stirring up division himself by singling out old white men as the cause of all the problems. So it's factually untrue that it's old white men who are causing all the racial division in New Zealand. You just have to look at the Maori Party. Look at what they did. You just have to look at Jacinda Ardern. She introduced a two-tier society. She demonized all the unvaccinated people. She refused to even meet at them when they protested at Parliament. There's plenty of people who aren't old white men who are creating a lot of division in New Zealand. So this is really about blaming the victim, and I think in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. And I responded by saying that old white men, this is, you know, quote unquote, old white men, and this includes everybody else who's listening, is not scared enough of what's coming. And that's the problem. Because obviously what they have in store for us is even worse than what many of us, I think, imagine it to be. So, yeah, I hope, as I said, I hope he sort of ends up radicalizing more people against his agenda, against his worldview, against what they have in store for us.
Well, now, I think that's what's going to happen, yeah.
And we're basically out of time. I think I'll give you sort of 60 seconds to tell me what you think about the government's performance. Basically, the quarterly reports that, quarterly targets and then reports that Christopher Luxon puts forward have rolled over. So we had the second quarter completed and the third quarter has begun. And this third quarter is supposedly going to focus on law and order. And the previous one, he said they achieved just about everything except for one thing that they were aiming to achieve. I've still got to go through some of the fine print, but for the most part, they tend to word things, their targets in such a way that they have been able to achieve them. And usually they've taken just part of coalition promises and delivered on just parts of them. Or they've said, we'll make some progress on this issue in this quarter, and they've made that progress. So on the whole, what do you think about just the overall performance and the track that they're putting themselves on?
Well, I was very excited when that coalition agreement was signed. I thought it was a great coalition agreement. I think it had a lot of things that a lot of people wanted in it. And it was one of the best and most conservative agreements and governments we'd seen for a while. As time has gone on, my skepticism has started to grow. So one reason is the immigration rate. And this, it's not something they explicitly campaigned on, but still they could have reined it in a little bit, and it doesn't appear at this point that they have. We still have a very, very high immigration rate. Another one is we're starting to see disagreements amongst the government, the agree to disagree clause being talked about. Things like the the women's sports and the trans people in sports guideline, for example.
And another one topical this week is the relationship sexuality guidelines in schools as well, the education in schools. And Rodney Hyde, one of our presenters here, wrote a good, great article on that you can find on his website. I mean, I say great, I mean disturbing and disgusting. And you've got to say, why these guidelines, this education, this program, why is it still in place? Like, this would be the easiest thing in the world to get rid of, and it's for some reason not considered a priority at all.
Yeah, so this is why my skepticism is growing. I'm starting to get the feeling that they've talked a good game on getting rid of things like this, you know, the sexuality curriculum, the transgender sexuality curriculum in schools, and, you know, the trans people in women's sports and a few of these other issues like that, but they're not actually doing it. They're trying to sell it as if they're doing it, but they're not actually going to go the whole hog and do these things. So that's why my skepticism of the government is growing. However, I think they're still doing a kind of reasonable job on some of the core stuff, even if they're not enthusiastic about some of the cultural and social issues. The budget, I mean, they could have cut it a bit more. They've promised to do a lot more cutting of government expenditure and do all their more fiscally responsible stuff in the future rather than doing it straight away. So, I mean, we have to wait and see, even on the fiscal and economic front, whether they're going to really live up to their promise. My skepticism is growing, though.
And just a reminder to people as well, I've got a coalitiontracker.nz that track all of the government's promises on. And I've got some updates that I'll make for the new quarter when I have some time. I haven't done it yet, but I will do that shortly. And definitely we will be keeping an eye on them. And that's what's very important. If you're listening, to keep on the pressure, keep complaining, make them deliver on their promises. And we can do that together.
That's right. Good point.
Well, thank you very much for joining me, William. We've run out of time for this week. And, well, you'll be back next week, as always. And any final comments or just a reminder for people to follow you? And then to the listeners, we'll be back right after the break.
Yeah, I mean, follow me at William McGimsey at The Zeitgeist NZ on Twitter or my YouTube channel, The Zeitgeist.
All right, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.